Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. In a WAMC listening area defined by several vibrant art scenes, perhaps none carries as much cachet as Woodstock, New York, so much so that its highlights have attained shorthand around here. Levon's Barn, Big Pink, Dylan's Motorcycle Accident, 3 days of Peace and Love. But renowned music writer Barney Hoskins argues in his new book that Woodstock has sometimes fallen short of its purest promise for residents both famous and not. The book, published by DeCapo Press, is Small Town Talk: Bob Dylan, The Band, Van Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix and Friends, in the Wild Years of Woodstock. Barney Hoskins, welcome to the Roundtable.
Nice to be here.
What got you interested in writing about Woodstock in this book?
Well, I've always been interested in the music that came out of the town. And then I lived there for a period in the 1990s. And really since then, or since about 99, I've thought there really was a big book to be written about what happened in the town musically and culturally between the early 60s and, roughly speaking, the late 80s. So it's broadly the kind of Albert Grossman years.
What got you interested as an Englishman in American music and then brought you to Woodstock itself?
Well, you know, I'd have to say that the band, who were really, you know, Woodstock's very own group, I suppose, or the preeminent Woodstock rock and roll band, did play quite a part in that, I think. While I was still sort of listening to T-Rex and David Bowie, I miraculously happened upon Rock of Ages by the band, and it sort of transported me into the world of what I suppose we call Americana now. I don't know why it should have been that record, but I bought it when I was about 14 years old. And I think that really set me on this course. But I was already, I mean, I guess, you know, smitten with all sorts of other American music and with just America really as a place, as an idea. And I first visited in about 1977. And so I just became an Americaphile very early in my life, as many Europeans and Brits do.
And vice versa, I should say, as a massive Who fan.
I know it works both ways.
Yeah. So give us sort of some background here on how Woodstock became the important location, the hub of a lot of the music that was being made, you know, in the 60s and 70s that still very much stands up today.
Well, I think it became the hub because it was already an artistic, you know, slash bohemian hub, as I'm sure you know very well. So the conditions were auspicious, and all sorts of artists, you know, painters, sculptors, and also writers, actors, and dare I say it, communists, had made Woodstock and the surrounding areas home throughout the 20th century up to that point, so that when Bob Dylan first set foot there as the guest of Peter Yarrow, who's the preacher of Peter, Paul, and Mary, it already, you know, it already had form as this kind of like Greenwich Village in the mountains, if you like. It was like a little bit of the village, plus maybe a bit of the Upper West Side, you know, set down in the Hudson Valley.
I guess once popular music started coming out of there with more frequency, it just became a sort of self-fulfilling that other artists would be attracted to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, particularly because of Dylan. I mean, Dylan was the magnet beyond anything else. The fact that he was spending time up there, the fact that he then had his accident and kind of disappeared up there, became this sort of recluse, was a huge draw. Because as you know, as I think many people know, you know, Dylan was, you know, he was the Messiah in that decade. So the fact that he chose Woodstock to disappear into, it was immensely intriguing for for many people. Everyone wanted to know what Bob was doing up there. And then when the kind of rumors of the music he was making with the Hawks started to percolate out from there, that was irresistible. And then it all really sort of came to fruition with the band's first album. So by 1968, you know, and certainly before the Woodstock Festival, people were going up there in search of, you know, whatever Dylan and the band had found there.
Except I think it's fair to say Dylan wasn't looking for acolytes to join him, per se.
No, and precisely, that's the sort of paradox of it, really. Dylan went there to escape, and that made him, you know, an irresistible sort of target, really, for all sorts of people, from George Harrison and Eric Clapton to, you know, fairly deranged hippies who were, you know, getting off the bus and demanding to know where Dylan's house was because, you know, I have to tell Bob something, you know. So that's the spectrum of people that were attracted to the place because of him. So he was trying to get away from people, and people were coming out there to find him, broadly speaking.
I mean, we went over this a bit in the title of your book, but take us through some of the other characters who were in town, who showed up. Who were some of the major figures who overlapped with this time period?
Well, I mean, there is a sort of brief window there in early 69 where I'd hazard that not only were Dylan and the band around, but probably in the same place and time, you might well have had Janis Joplin visiting, you know, her new manager, Albert Grossman, who was also Dylan's, of course. But and also Jimi Hendrix in the house out near Boyceville. You probably would have had Tim Hardin around. You'd have had Paul Butterfield and his band moving to town. And then all manner of more obscure artists who were moving up there, moving into band houses where they could live and rehearse. There was a place called the Peter Pan Farm where lots of musicians and assorted hippies were kind of camping out. These Sound Out festivals were happening in 68, 69. They were the kind of precursor to the big Woodstock Festival. So there's a period there in 69 where all these people are kind of milling around and bumping into each other and jamming with each other and doing other things together.
You mentioned Albert Grossman, a ubiquitous figure in the music scene of this time and in town. If there's a villain to be found in your book, it might be Albert Grossman. But what credit do you think he deserves for establishing the Woodstock that we know today?
Oh, I mean, huge credit. And I wouldn't want to use the V word about Albert. I mean, he's certainly, I think villainous is too strong because there's lots of good things about Albert, too. He's an immensely ambiguous figure who I feel very ambivalent about, as I think many do. You can't underestimate what Albert did, you know, for Woodstock, but also for the many extraordinary artists that he managed and represented. But he certainly saw Woodstock as a place to establish his own kind of like, I mean, you could almost call it Albertsville. I think he had this vision of Woodstock / Bearsville as a place where, you know, he was really going to put down some cultural roots. He was going to, he wanted to bring musicians up there. He wanted to record them. He wanted to feed them. He wanted to house them. And that's the kind of, you know, that's the nurturing side of Albert, you know, the sort of big daddy of the story. So, and that kind of lasts right through beyond when Dylan leaves, and Albert launches Bearsville Records, and Todd Rundgren eventually moves up there. There's all sorts of other stuff going on up there that all flows directly or indirectly from Albert's patronage.
You know, there have certainly been several people who've, you know, made a life there and stayed. Elliot Landy, the band photographer, who was in the studio the other day talking about this period too, but others did not stay. Why did people in general, you know, get sick of the Woodstock scene or just leave for other reasons? Can you take us through that a bit?
Well, I think, you know, paradoxically, Woodstock attracted these quite complex maverick figures, and I think somewhat introspective figures. It also attracted its fair share of gregarious extroverts. But if you think about people like Dylan and Van Morrison, you know, they're not the kind of people who want to be the life and soul of the party. You know, they are quite complicated figures, and I think for a period both those men found Woodstock to be a sort of creative sanctuary, and then that spell kind of wore off, I think. And for the, it all coalesced around the festival itself, I think. That really changed the nature of the town. Once the festival, even though, as we know, it didn't take place really anywhere near Woodstock, it was still called Woodstock, and it then brought many, many more people up there. And I think that was a real turnoff for the likes of Dylan and Van Morrison. I mean, these are guys who really abide by that Groucho Marx idea of, you know, I don't want to be a member of any club that's inviting me to join. And even though I didn't get to speak with Dylan, no great surprise, I was fortunate enough to interview Van Morrison. I think that was pretty much how he felt. He felt that, you know, Woodstock was a victim of its own mythology, really. The festival kind of ruined the place, which I think is really overstating it, because actually there's lots of great things that happen in Woodstock and Bearsville and surrounding areas in the early 70s. In many ways, I think the golden age of Woodstock probably is like 71, 72.
You've covered music for a long time, and scenes always spring up. Seattle, Woodstock, you name it. In 2016, how important do you think a physical scene is to our new music?
Well, I think things have changed very radically in the digital, interconnected, socially mediated age. There's no doubt about that. And I think that's kind of sad. I think many people feel that's kind of sad. It's not as if physical places don't exist anymore, but the nature of how we experience them or discover them, I think that has changed. I don't think you could replicate, and maybe you shouldn't want to replicate, a scene like Woodstock or any of the other scenes we could cite, you know, Haight Ashbury, Austin, Texas, you name it. But if we wanted to, I think it would be very difficult because, you know, it's very hard to nurture or develop a cultural scene now in a way that isn't immediately, you know, quote unquote, shared with the world, you know, at the kind of click of a keyboard. Everything is so sort of immediately dispersed through the internet. And in that, I think that means that people don't feel anchored to any one place anymore. There isn't that same sense of locality. You know, people are experiencing things from all over the world, instantaneously, all this information is sort of flooding into their computers and their smartphones. And I think that's really changed the nature of the way that music scenes evolve.
You were back in town recently with the Woodstock Writers Festival talking about this book. I wonder how your book's being received in town.
Well, you'd have to ask the folks there.
Oh, I mean, fair enough.
You know, I felt, you know, welcomed there. I felt people were essentially approving of the book, with some exceptions. but in the main, people seemed to welcome it, and I think certainly to respect the fact that I did my best to, you know, tell the truth about the place, you know, warts and all. You know, you have to take the rough with the smooth. I mean, I think, you know, for me, it's like a love letter to the town and to the musical legacy of the place. I think some people feel that you know, maybe I kind of depicted the sort of decline, or, you know, you could say the moral and chemical decline of the place through the 70s. Perhaps I depicted that too unflinchingly. I don't know. But in a way, that's what happens to music scenes, you know, that they do get tarnished and to some degree corrupted, and they do decline. They rise and they fall. It's still a great music town. There's still a lot of great musicians there, but for a number of reasons, it can't be what it was. Times have changed, and, you know, there are drink driving laws now that weren't implemented quite so thoroughly back in those times. I think they've affected the, you know, the live music culture generally, not just in Woodstock, but it has particularly impacted on Woodstock, which can't sustain a live music scene in the way that it once could. But I think that what I would say is there's been a real renaissance in the Hudson Valley and in upstate New York in general, I think, whereby a lot of musicians have started moving into the area over the last five to 10 years, and more are moving up there. You know, people refer to Hudson as, you know, Williamsburg North. You know, for obvious reasons, there are many creative, young creative people who simply can't afford to live in or anywhere near New York City anymore. And they are moving up. And I think they're moving up there partly because of the legacy, because they do know something about Dylan and Big Pink and everything else that happened. And I hope my book will introduce people to lots of other stuff that they might not have been aware of, that I wasn't even necessarily aware of. You know, somebody like Karen Dalton, I think, is such a fascinating figure. And until I started really researching the book, I didn't realize she had spent so much time up in and near Woodstock. I mean, I knew about her, the album she'd made at Bearsville, but she's one of the most extraordinary artists, and it's a tragic tale in many ways. But there's so much great music. I mean, Tim Hardin, you know, one of the greatest singers ever to come out of America, I think, and like Karen, a bit of a mess, but my God, what a voice. What a writer.
Sticking with that theme, I wanted to ask you about your reaction to the death of Prince. You wrote an early biography of his and covered him in the years after that. I think that book was in the late 80s. What do you make of this story?
I mean, I just was flabbergasted, really. I just, you know, no one saw that coming. Maybe insiders knew more than we did, but I'm not even sure that they saw this coming. So I still haven't really got my head around it. You know, it's just a massive shock, following on from perhaps a slightly less shocking loss of Bowie. But, you know, that was tremendously shocking and upsetting as well. But Prince, one thinks of Prince as this extraordinary, extraordinarily dynamic and energetic figure. You know, I mean, it's hard to, if one ever saw him perform, you don't think of him as someone who's going to die at the age of 58. So I just sort of left me reeling, really.
We've been speaking with Barney Hoskins, the author of Small Town Talk, Bob Dylan, The Band, Van Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix and Friends, In the Wild Years of Woodstock. Barney, just a great read and a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ian. Pleasure to speak with you.
It's all small town talk. You know how people are. They can't stand to see someone else doing what they like.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.